So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention to the stars now a little bit with Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place. He's also a faculty associate in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. UW Space Place is located in Madison on South Park Street, 2300 South Park in the Villager Mall. Please, Jim, nice to have you back.
Nice to be here, Larry. Thanks.
And Tom Hall, great to have you back as well.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
Tom is an optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton, and Tom and Jim come by every so often to talk with us about stars and stargazing, and certainly if you have some questions as we move along today, you're most welcome to join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments, and we'll be glad to get you on the air. And really, the other night, Venus and the moon were just beautiful sight.
Yeah, a lot of people noticed that and mentioned it to me. I saw it, too. In fact, I had we had our astronomy students out at Washburn Observatory, but it was as nice just to stand outside the dome and look up at the sky as it was to look through the telescope.
Yeah, it was a wonderful sight. And May, the month of May, we've got a blue moon coming.
Blue moon, and if you like that sight on Thursday night with the moon and Venus, there'll be an even closer approach in May when the two will stand about. We'll see, when is that? When the two will stand about. I think it's a degree apart, and the moon, the full moon, is about. It'll be 19th of May is when that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. The full moon itself is about a half a degree wide. That's how we measure distances on the sky, is in angular units like that. So the full moon is about half a degree wide. The moon's going to be about 1 degree away from Venus, so only about 2 of its own diameters away from Venus. So that'll be a lot closer than it was just last Thursday night. So you're not 19th of May. And then, then we'll have a blue moon. We'll have 2 full moons during the calendar month of May. That's one of those things where if you ask somebody in England if there's going to be a blue moon, they'll have to say no, because May will end in England 6 hours before it ends for us, and the full moon won't happen until after that transition. So we'll have a blue moon in May, and they won't.
And they won't. And this happens, what, every few years or...?
I think the average, it's something like 2.5 years on the average that we get this so-called blue moon, this second full moon in a calendar month. It's bound to happen sometimes, because the moon is full every roughly 29 and a half days. And, of course, the months that we have are typically longer than that by just a little bit. So if a full moon occurs right at the beginning of a month, then you can often sneak in, not often, but occasionally sneak in a second one by the end of the month.
Yeah. Tom, what have you been up to over at Eagle Optics?
Well, we've been pretty busy these days, actually. We're expanding some operations and getting into optical equipment for sportsmen and hunters. So we're doing our own rifle scopes these days, and binoculars and spotting scopes and small telescopes still, of course. So it's been a busy 6 months for us here. Some new equipment coming through. We're doing a lot of our own design work and branching out in some new areas.
What's your website address again, by the way?
That's eagleoptics.com.
Now, that's an easy one to remember.
That's an easy one.
Eagleoptics.com. And for the space place, I want to get that in, too, before I forget.
Spaceplace.org will do it. So we're trying to keep those easy to remember.
Well, that's a good thing. Dr. Sam Ting of MIT has spent the past 10 years building a 10,000-pound cosmic ray detector at a cost of $1.5 billion.
Yep.
That's a lot of cash.
Yep.
What's it supposed to do? It's almost ready to fly, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. That's my understanding, is that instrument is ready to fly. It's on schedule. But what's not ready to fly is the shuttle. It's designed to be flown on the shuttle. And the current state of shuttle operations now is that NASA is limiting those to only the ones absolutely necessary to finish the International Space Station. Mm-hmm. And one other mission to service the Hubble Space Telescope, which they really sort of got pressured into by a lot of us who were concerned that they were just going to let the Hubble go. And my guess is that they won't be able to muster, that we won't be able to muster the political pressure to get another shuttle flight designated for Ting's mission. But when that project was first funded, the way those typically work, or used to work, I guess is the way to put it, is that the shuttle flight was in effect free. I mean, they cost a lot. A shuttle mission costs a whole lot. But they used to assign the science awards for these instruments and then just say, and we'll launch it. By the way, that's part of the deal. NASA says, here's the money to develop this special instrument, and we'll send it up on one of these shuttle flights, which, of course, we're going to be having pretty commonly all the way into the foreseeable future. But those have gone away. And so now the only alternative would be to figure out a way to lift that on some fairly heavy launch vehicle, because it was built to be lifted on the space shuttle, which carries a big load.
Right.
And that launch would cost a lot of money. That would now be back on the budget, what was previously off the budget because the shuttle flights were quote-unquote free. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't actually look very good. It's going to be a trick to find another way to put that thing in space. But it's scientifically very interesting because these cosmic rays are pretty mysterious. We still don't really know where they come from, although there's some recent evidence that suggests that they get accelerated out of supernova remnants. At least some of them might come from the fantastic magnetic fields around supernova remnants. But figuring out where these highly energetic particles come from could tell us a lot about the structure of magnetic fields in the galaxy and how the processes that accelerate particles work. But it's going to take an instrument like Ting's observatory to do it, and for the moment it's on the ground.
I would guess that Dr. Ting, after 10 years and $1.5 billion, isn't a real happy camper about now.
I'm sure you're right.
Holy cow. Oh, my goodness. Well, somebody wondered, here's a question in the binocular area. Somebody wondered about the differences between a Vortex Viper 8x42 and a Steiner Peregrine XP 8x44 binocular. Well, right off the top of your head, Tom.
Yeah. Well, one of those is actually one of the new binoculars that we've developed. Vortex is one of our sister companies, if you will, and we're, again, marketing to, you know, people that are into the outdoors, hunters, or anybody who does work out with the Fish and Wildlife Service, somebody who needs something real durable. So the Vortex Viper is something that we import from Japan to our specifications. Very lightweight. I mean, it's a really light, very tough piece, extremely bright, has some ED glass in it, or the same thing that we use in telescopes that give you a little sharper, crisper image. The Steiner Peregrine, Steiner's one of those companies that has dealt with the military for many years. So they tend to build a little heavier, overbuilt equipment, real tough standards. That also uses Japanese technology. Steiner's a German company, but they'll import a lot from overseas, just like everybody does. So that one's a bit heavier by half a pound and gathers a smidge more light, kind of meant to be less maybe of a field piece, but a real durable binocular, also excellent quality. And it costs a little more, unfortunately. Steiner, one of the German companies, you'll typically pay a little
but
more for
those. Half a pound is a lot when it comes to a pair of binoculars.
Well, a lot of people, will notice that.
Hanging around your neck
if
all
you can
day.
If you can get a 23-ounce binocular versus a 31-ounce one, that's the point where everybody notices it, especially birders or people working in the field, naturalists, or, like I say, people with the Fish and Wildlife Service. They're out there using them 8 hours a day. So they like equipment to be as versatile as possible, lightweight as they can get in their kit, all that sort of stuff.
Tom Hall and Jim Lattice, our guests today, as we talk with them about the stars and gazing through at those stars. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. By the way, before I forget about it, a couple of days from now, you've got an event. You have a few events coming up. Maybe we should talk about a couple of those.
Right. We do have a few things coming up at Space Place in the very near future. Well, in fact, tomorrow night, I'll be giving my the monthly talk I give called Eyes in the Skies, where we usually talk about some of the things we talk about here, what's happening in the sky, except we can use visual aids and things like that, what's happening in the sky and astronomical news, that sort of thing. And those are very informal sorts of occasions too. If you haven't been to one of those, we can, you know, we handle questions pretty much anything anybody wants to talk about. So Friday night we have the first of our Friday night music programs. I say first because I expect we're going to do more, but it's the only one scheduled right now. But we've been working with the music school to develop some interdisciplinary programs. And Friday nights, second and fourth Friday nights, is when we open up our observing deck at Space Place. So this Friday night, we're going to try doing a little musical performance of musically inspired piano pieces by some performers from the UW School of Music, UW-Madison
cool.
School of Music. And then, weather permitting, we'll go up and do some stargazing, and suitably inspired by the music. We'll get out some
Very
telescopes.
Cool.
And then next month's guest speaker at Space Place, it'll be on May 8th, should be a really interesting talk. That's going to be by Dr. Marcia Wolf, who's in the UW-Madison Astronomy Department. And she's been researching how galaxies that host quasars, what's the relationship between the quasar, which is a super bright light source, and the galaxy itself. And this turns out to be a tricky thing to work out. So her talk is entitled Quasars, Black Holes, and Galaxies, Which Comes First? So that'll be on Tuesday, May 8th at 7 p.m. So a lot of things coming up.
Excellent. And, of course, all that's up on your website.
Of course,
Space
yeah.
Place, you bet. Peggy in Monona, we'll give you a chance now. Peggy, hi. Thank you for calling. I tell you what, Peggy, we've got such a terrible connection. But the question was, she's been told that the full moon rises directly opposite the sunset.
That's right. If that was the question, then that's certainly correct. That what it means to have a full moon is that it's directly opposite the sun in the sky, so we see the fully lighted face of the moon. What we were seeing on last Thursday night. A crescent moon. The moon was, maybe 60 degrees, no less, probably
less.
40 degrees from the sun. So the sun goes down below the horizon, and then not far above the horizon, where from where the sun went down, you see the moon. But at that time, you're looking at mostly the night side of the moon and a sliver of the daylight side of the moon. So we're seeing that crescent. But as the moon moves eastward in its path night by night, it gets to the opposite side of the sky from the sun 15 days or so after it was new. And then it's directly opposite the sun. We see the full daylight side of the moon, so the full moon. And because it's 180 degrees opposite in the sky from the sun, it has to be rising as the sun sets. And it has to be, if the sun is a little bit north of the horizon, then you'll see the moon rising a little bit south of the... If the sun is setting a little bit north of the of due west, then the moon will be rising a little bit south of due east.
Gotcha. Thanks, Peggy. Paul in Marshfield, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Larry, this may be more of a question for you than for your guest, but I'm wondering if you've ever given a thought to having these guys on and having people call in stating what their favorite astronomical books or tools or information sources are, something that just kind of a maybe like a round table, a way that an amateur astronomer like myself can get a feel for what other people are using.
That's a great idea.
That's a great idea. We can do a little of that right now, as a matter of fact, if people want to call in as we visit. What's your favorite book?
Well, I was just thinking, I guess I'd really like a few minutes to put together a list.
Yeah.
But what I'm working on my favorite book right now, just at the moment, I'm reading Neil deGrasse Tyson's Death by Black Hole. And that's a fun book. It's a collection of short essays that were published in other places, primarily, I think, maybe all of them in Natural History magazine. He writes a column. I think mm-hmm. we named that right, or is it Smithsonian? No, I think it's Natural History. But the book is a collection of these essays that are reminiscent of the kind of thing I remember reading by Isaac Asimov years ago. And they're little chunks about he's an astronomer at the American Museum of Natural History out there. But a very thoughtful one. It puts together some really nice little essays. So that's right off the top of my head. That's what I'm using.
What's the title again?
It's called Death by Black Hole. I think that's one of the subject of one of the essays is what happens when you fall into a black hole, which is one of those questions we all have from time to time.
And Tom, have you got one right off the top of your head?
Oh, sure. One of our favorites has always been Night Watch by Terence Dickinson and Alan Dyer. From our perspective, it's a great primer, if you will, for people just getting into the hobby of astronomy. Explains a lot about equipment. It has some nice charts for beginners to use. It's kind of an all-inclusive, good starting point for virtually anybody, although it's well-written enough that you can get as deeply into it as you'd like and get into some of the math and how to use telescopes and setting circles. That's always been a classic. Again, that one is Night Watch.
Night Watch.
And that book, now that you mentioned it, that shades over then into tools, because that book is almost an observing tool, really.
Oh, exactly, yeah.
But these little... they're often called star finders, that planispheres. A little planisphere is it's a little thing with it's two disks, really, usually two disks that are pivoted together in the middle. And you can set it to a time and a date, and it shows you what stars are going to be overhead at that time. And for $2, I think you can get them for $2 from, well, we sell them at Space Place, the paper ones. And there are some nicer ones, but you don't have to spend more than 10 to get a nice heavy plastic one. And it replaces a whole lot of computer hardware. It predates a whole lot of computer hardware, too. And it's just a great little tool for astronomical use.
All right. There you have it, Paul.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much. And
thanks, Paul.
And if we have some others, as you call in, if you have a favorite book to share, please do. If you don't, that's fine, too. Tom Hall, our guest today, optics specialist with Eagle Optics of Middleton, and Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking astronomy today with our two guests, Jim Lattice and Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Give us a call if you have a question or a comment or maybe a book that you'd like to recommend to our listeners as well. And as a matter of fact, Jim, you might be able to put something together, a little list for another show.
Sure. Yeah, I think that might be a lot of fun. We could do useful astronomical tools and books. That would be cool.
John in Washington County, we'll turn to you now. Hi, John.
Hi there, Larry. Good question for your guests. You were talking about the Hubble telescope. I'd like to know what the status is and the future is of the Hubble telescope and why they're going up all the time to repair it and what the status is right now.
Well, currently the advanced camera is down, as right. I recall, and they had the scope in safe mode, they called it, in January, where everything was locked down, if I recall, but they brought it slowly up out of that, and there is hopefully one more servicing mission, as Jim had mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I think that's next year, 08 sometime. I'm not sure what the schedule is the... And you ask why they have to go up there every so often. It's there are the things that we've usually heard most about are the gyros, but they've also had battery and power supply problems. These things that get operated constantly, especially the ones that are mechanical like the gyros, literally wear out. You have to remember that they have to point that object that's the size of a school bus. They have to point that to within a thousandth of an arc second accuracy. And so when the gyros get a little slop in the bearings there, they're not good for that anymore. So they have to replace those on a sort of a regular, not regulars exactly, but they have to repair them when they, or the observatory is useless if they don't replace those things. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons for the solar panels degrade under the radiation from the sun. And so the power available goes down. But as Tom says, there are also some problems. They typically will upgrade the instruments. There are four primary instrument slots on the shuttle, and they're going to... Oh, it's the Cosmic Origin Spectrograph is one that's on the ground. I think it's ready to go, and it's at the next servicing mission. They're going to install that instrument and take out something. I'm not sure what's coming out. It might be COSTAR. At any rate, they're going to put in that new instrument and refurbish the telescope, get it in good operating shape. And that there were no plans to replace that advanced camera for surveys, but I think they've given up hope on that, at least the last I heard.
I believe that's right. But there's still three good working instruments on Hubble, so it's still a worthwhile project in most people's opinion that follow it.
Right, little lens cleaner.
Yeah, right. Squeegee off the windshield. Yeah,
what
the
is going up, what is the current objective of the Hubble telescope? What are they supposed to be doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a general purpose observatory, and so astronomers come to it with a myriad of research questions. And when there's, say, well, for instance, the studies of these quasars in distant galaxies, it's an interesting question. What kind of galaxy gives rise to a quasar, which is a source of radiation probably coming, almost surely coming from a supermassive black hole deep inside of galaxies? Some galaxies have them and some don't. You'd like to know what kinds of galaxies produce those, and it's very difficult to see the galaxy. It's a little bit like seeing a, at night you have a car coming towards you, and you'd like to know what model car that is.
Yeah.
But you can't read the nameplate on the front because you're blinded by the headlights. That's what happens when you look at a quasar in a galaxy. It's this blinding source of light, and you can't actually see what kind of galaxy, or well, you can, but it's difficult. The Hubble is really good for such kinds of things that require very, very high-resolution imaging and very low light detection levels. And so there are many, many problems that it's going to work on. The Cosmic Origins spectrograph will be especially adapted for looking at the spectra of very, very faint, distant galaxies, which will help tell us things like how fast the universe is expanding and accelerating, and what the characteristics of objects like in the very early universe were. So the Hubble has a wide range of applicability, and after that servicing mission, it ought to be able to go for, well, the life of the next set of gyros and batteries and solar panels. But then the NASA has said after that, no more servicing missions because there's not going to be any more shuttle. So that'll probably they'll have to shut it down at some point.
And that'll be so it'll probably run for several more years.
I'm just guessing, but probably at least should be good for 2, 3, 4, 5 years after the last servicing mission, depending on how cranky everything gets.
Is there a website for the Hubble?
Oh, certainly. I'm sure if you just search for Hubble Space Telescope, you'll find the official NASA site. It's probably.
I think they call it Hubble Site, all strung together as one word.
HubbleSite.gov or something.
H-U-B-L-E.
Two Bs. H-U-B-B-L-E-S-I-T-E. And then we're not sure.
That should get you to it.
.org or .gov or something.
Okay.
Maybe .nasa.gov.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yes. And let's take some more calls here. Tim in Oshkosh, I believe you are next. Hi, Tim. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. I have a couple, or just a question for your guests, having to do with the types of binoculars that they might recommend for a novice or a beginner in looking at the skies. I quite often find myself camping with a geology student. I'm a geology instructor, and we're always looking at the stars, and I like to have something that I can set up rather quickly that's not too fragile or difficult to or time-consuming to actually place, in the field while we're moving from spot to spot. And, I like to get as much resolution as possible, but I know there's this trade-off with just portability and ease of setup when we're looking at those things. So is there a particular type of binocular that you guys would actually recommend using?
Certainly. And for that matter, there'd be a couple that we could steer you towards, depending on if you were hoping to spend only, say, in the neighborhood of $200, or if you can budget all the way up to somewhere around $500, you can get some of the very best.
Okay. And the very best, do they offer you just crisper images or higher magnification or a combination of both?
Oddly enough, not necessarily higher magnification, but certainly crisper images.
Oh, okay.
And more light gathering. I mean, part of what you're buying into there is same thing they attempt to do with Hubble. You're trying to gather more light so you can see fainter structure.
Right.
And the classics still today, and it has been for almost 10 years, I would say, are the Fujinon Polaris series binoculars. Those are superb. They're not the most expensive, but they're perhaps the best.
Okay.
Those like 7x50? Or
they make a 7x50. They make a 10x70 that you can get into if you can carry the weight, or if you want to use a lawn chair or some sort of assist to help you lean back and hold the binoculars. The 10x70s are kind of twin telescopes.
Okay.
I mean, they're pretty big. But even those are only $590 or so. But the Fujinon 7x50 is kind of a classic piece, originally developed as a marine binocular so that yachtsmen could use them to find buoys at dusk. And of course, astronomers will use them for the same reasons. Low light gathering capabilities means that you can use them and see really nice structure to the really dim objects.
And what do those run, those 50s?
Those are around $500. Really an excellent piece of equipment. Around 200, Nikon makes some very nice 7x50s or 10x50s. And I did want to mention, you know, virtually any binocular will assist you at night. I mean, you can use most any binoculars out there in the field, and if you've got field pieces you're already using with the geology students, I mean, go ahead and use those. And Jim and I always like to recommend the lawn chair technique rather than tripods, perhaps, but if you don't have chairs that you can get out there, any of these could be mounted on tripods also. It's just there you're going to spend a lot on a tripod that's beefy enough to hold these up at eye level. There, it's almost more work, and, you know, you mentioned packability or maybe being able to get them around. It's almost nicer to use them out at the campsite, just leaning back in the decent lawn chair, and you're already kind of presented as looking up then. The binoculars can be quite comfortable in that position.
And 10 by 70s, they're still within the threshold that if I'm holding them with my, you know, hands rather than a tripod, I'm not going to have an issue with, you know, basically finding the object or staying still enough to actually view it.
Well, I don't know there. How big a guy are you? those are heavy. They really are. Like I say, they're almost twin spotting scopes. So
okay.
Those would be a little more difficult, although, again, if you've got arm support and elbow support, you could do it with that. But those are getting pretty heavy.
Okay.
A superb instrument, though, and a terrific astronomical binocular.
Okay, great.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in as well if you have a question as we talk binoculars, telescopes, and the stars with Jim Lattice and Tom Hall. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And let's turn to Bill in Lac des Flambeaux next. Bill, hello.
Hello there.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm curious about the blue moon. More specifically, the months that have no moon.
Hmm. No full moon, you mean?
No full moon, yes.
Yeah.
How infrequent is that? Is it more or less frequent than a blue moon, say?
I would guess. I'm not sure the answer to that. I would guess it's a lot less frequent than this blue moon that we're talking about, because there's only February.
Right, one opportunity out of 12 instead of... 11 out of 12.
Yeah. So that seems like, did that happen just recently? That sounds vaguely familiar. I think maybe we just had, maybe it was last year or something like that. We might have had one of those months. But it must be a lot less frequent. But you're quite right that it can certainly happen, because February is most of the time only 28 days. And even when it's longer, it's 29 days. And the lunation period is 29 and a half days. So you could end up with a full moon, you know, during the last hours of January, and then you wouldn't have another one until the first hours of March. So you could skip, but I don't know how often that happens. Not very often.
Not very often.
So maybe we should be, rather than saying once in a blue moon, we should say once in a no moon.
There you go.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Dave in McQuanigo, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
A number of years ago, I bought a pair of field binoculars 10x40 from Eagle Optics. Real happy with them. They were, I believe, called Rangers. But I'm looking for something in that same size, 10x40 or maybe even a 12x40, mm-hmm. that would be more of a pocket-sized binocular, and I'm wondering what you would suggest.
Okay. And first off, we'd have to say that you can't get a 10x40 or a 12x40 and have them pocket-size.
Okay.
By reason of that second number. The second number is just a measurement, a literal, you know, diameter measurement of the front objective of the binocular. So if you have them 40 millimeters in diameter, none of those are going to be small enough to fit in your pocket.
So maybe 10 by 28 then?
Exactly. Most of the true pocket sizes are going to be down in the 20s. 10 by 20, 10 by 25, 10 by 28. I won't recommend 12s in that size range. They're pretty hard to hold steady, because a pocket binocular, you're holding with your fingertips kind of anyway. And it's hard enough to hold 10s as it is. So 10 by 25 is a kind of a lower limit. Now, on the plus side, you do have lots of choices in a 10 by 25 where you can truly fit them into a pocket. I mean, we must carry almost 30 binoculars that would qualify for that. You'll look for a style that has two hinges instead of a single double, or instead of a single center hinge.
Mm-hmm.
Look for the twin hinge style where both the barrels can fold right next to each other. And that way they'll slip into a shirt pocket. And you can find those. Again, Nikon makes a very nice one in the, you know, $80 range. You can find a whole bunch of them under $100. You can get the very best of the Germans and still stay under $400. And get a 10x25 that's a gorgeous instrument. You can use them at the theater also. They, you know, they'll be small enough that you do take them, you know, virtually anywhere you might like to do that, especially out in the car or in the field if you're hiking.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Jim in Jackson, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. Another question on binoculars.
Oh, okay.
I'm one of those lounge chair persons nowadays, since it's just beyond my body to put together the telescope anymore. But I've got a pair of 4-inch binoculars, the big ones.
Okay.
Wow.
During the day, they're just dandy. They work at the marsh wonderfully. But at night, I notice that they're just a tad off. I can actually twist them back into alignment with my hand.
Oh, you mean the alignment itself, so the twin barrels aren't exactly pointed in the same direction.
Yeah, when you look at a star, you can notice the slight imperfection there.
Boy, that's a common problem with those very large aperture binoculars, 100 millimeters to 120 millimeters. That's where you're getting up into the 4-inch or 5-inch diameter. And the barrels are so long that it becomes difficult for... Does this have a hinge also mounted at the front end of the binocular where the objectives are?
No.
So the barrels go all the way back into the prism assembly.
There's a double hinge, but not way at the front.
Now, you may even be able to get those aligned.
That's what I was asking for. Anybody that you could recommend in southeast Wisconsin?
Very close, at least. There's a place in Libertyville, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
An all-time classic repair place. And, boy, their current name is going to escape me. you can do a web search, actually, on binocular repair. They're one of the very first that are going to pop up. They've been in business for over 50 years, and they've changed their name once or twice. They used to be in downtown Chicago, but now currently in Libertyville, Illinois.
So if you say binocular repair,
and
in Liberty, Illinois,
that'll pull up for you.
Okay, very good. And then the only other thing I'd ask is that, you know, every time you get on the air, please plug a low-power eyepiece. My favorite of all time is a 30-power with about an 80-degree field of view.
Well, there's a very good point to make, that most people think that high power is what you look for astronomy, and it's usually quite the opposite, actually. The lower power views give you a wider field. They give you a deeper contrast to the object. You'll often see more structure at lower powers than you will at higher powers.
Beautiful views.
You bet.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Someone just phoned in to say the new moon comes around every 5.9 years.
The no moon?
I'm sorry, the no moon, not the full moon. The no moon, the result of 29.5 times 365.25.
Wow.
Gives you 5.9.
More often than I would have thought.
Ed in Burlington, your turn. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I have a pair of Bushnell, I don't really know how to say it, but I think that's how it's called, binoculars.
Yep.
But I see double images when I look through mine. What's causing that?
Well, that also may be the same thing the last gentleman was talking about. The two barrels of the binocular are now pointed in slightly different directions. In other words, one is pointed up a little more than the other one. You can't really resolve the image into a single image when you do that. And again, you'll need to bring it in for repair.
Okay.
There's a place, I should mention, there's a place here in Madison called BDC Camera Repair that can often do those sorts of things for binoculars. But where are you located? Where is it you'd have to try to?
Burlington, Wisconsin.
Oh, sure.
Outside of Racine County.
Yeah, either way, Libertyville, Illinois there for the repair service they have down there, or BDC Camera here in Madison might be an equally close shot for you. You can send them into Bushnell, and they'll do them for you, too, but you'll have to send them in through the mail, and you're kind of dealing with a larger company. They may take a little longer to do them.
All right.
But, yeah, you'll need realignment on that, and sometimes it's a simple operation, depending on how nice the binocular is or how easy the technician's made for getting at the screws that do that or getting at to the prisms themselves for aligning, but it's something that can probably be done for you.
Okay. All right. What causes it to become out of alignment?
Oh, usually dropping. Yeah, that's the classic impacting against some hard surface. Usually at a range of about 4 feet, if you get my drift.
Okay.
But yeah, that can hopefully be taken care of if there's no broken glass or if, you know, the prisms haven't really unglued or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. And Jack in Waukesha, hi to you.
Oh, what do you see through binoculars that you won't see through a monocular?
Astronomically? Astronomically, you're going to have better perception of the details. If you've got two good eyes, your brain is going to make more sense of, say, wispy details in a nebula or something along that line if you're using both eyes than if you're using one.
That's a pretty well-documented phenomenon, actually, that your head really likes to process using both eyes, and you'll resolve better if you can actually, and I realize it may be a little more bulk, if you can bring an instrument that lets you use both eyes.
Say it's better. Then how is it better? I was born with one good eye, so I've never seen a binocular thing of any kind.
Gotcha.
So what is different between your binocular sight and my monocular sight?
Well, if we look at something like the Orion Nebula, which has some very extended wispy details to it that you really don't even make. I don't even make them out when I look directly at them. I have to use what they call averted vision because the retina of the eye is a little more sensitive off-center, actually significantly more sensitive off-center than it is directly in the center. So if you've got your object in the middle of the field and you look a little bit off-center, details will sort of spring into appearance, will suddenly become noticeable. It's something like that going from one eye to two eyes, that with just one eye, you're not quite making out some very, just right on the edge of detectability details, but with both eyes, the impression is clearer.
And one other quick physical note, we've had people, you know, in the same boat as you who've commented that they find binoculars easier to use just physically, because they're holding them in both hands, they can focus a binocular with their forefinger, and most binoculars, you have to focus the eyepiece itself. So you're kind of gripping the binocular with one hand, and you're turning the eyepiece with the other hand. It's not as steady of a grip, and doesn't seem to operate as well for people.
So even if you're using only one side of the binoculars,
it's still... Even if you're only using one eye, binoculars may do better for you.
Interesting. Thanks, Jack, very much for calling. And Jim and Tom, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. And again, your
fun
websites for all of your great things.
Spaceplace.org will do it.
Spaceplace.org. And Tom?
EagleOptics.com.
EagleOptics.com. Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, and Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics, our guests today. And they'll be back, and we'll do this again. In the meantime, get out there and take a look at the moon and Venus and the blue moons in May. There's a lot to see in those skies. Appreciate having them with us. And again, they'll be back in probably a month or so, and we'll talk with them again. Coming up, we're going to take a look at insurance choices for seniors. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.